From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. There is an obesity epidemic here in the United States. According to the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, more than 2 in 5 American adults are obese and nearly 1 in 5 American children are obese. So is a drug used to help decrease blood sugar levels in type 2 diabetics the answer to weight loss? There is a debate raging right now on whether or not Ozempic and other drugs like it should be used to treat weight loss because, as some doctors say, it could be sending the wrong message. So here to break this down for us is Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. Dr. Pate, good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gemma.
And Dr. Pate, also I want to let people know that if you want to send an email about public health, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. So Dr. Pate, let's talk a little bit about this because I feel like I cannot pick up a magazine, I cannot scroll through social media without hearing about Ozempic or some other drugs like it, how it's this miracle cure for weight loss. However, there are some health professionals, not all, who are being cautious about the use of this drug for weight loss. In fact, there's an article in Forbes magazine that was just recently published where one physician says Ozempic is sending the wrong message about weight loss. So first off, can we talk about what this drug is and what it was, what its original intention was to be used for?
Yeah, so this drug and some others like it were developed as a treatment for type 2 diabetes. And when we say type 2, that's as opposed to the type of diabetes that we refer to as being insulin dependent, whereas where people really don't have the insulin and they have to supplement it with shots of insulin. This Ozempic is not insulin. It's something that gives the pancreas kind of a push to make more insulin and get the blood sugars under control. And for many diabetics, this is a welcome addition because it only has to be taken weekly as opposed to most diabetic medications that have to be taken daily or more than once daily. And so that was the intention. What was found is that this, as you mentioned, this medication does also have the effect of causing weight loss. And of course, weight loss often additionally helps with diabetes control in type 2 diabetics. So kind of a double win there. But then it was the use, you know, off-label. It's not, the FDA has not approved it for this purpose, but it will cause weight loss in many people that don't have diabetes as well. So it has become kind of a go-to drug, especially for those that are in a more financially advantaged position to be able to get this medication because it is quite expensive, but to take it for weight loss. And I think what the concerns are that, number one, the intense demand for this medication, especially by those that just want to use it for weight loss, has made it harder to get for people that actually need it for their diabetes. Number two is it is, because of the way that our financial markets work, that increase in demand has not only caused shortages, but has caused the price to go up or stay up rather than coming down as we would hope. And then, of course, there's the concern that this is just going to further increase disparities between the haves and have-nots because most people are not going to be able to afford this medication. Now, moving on to the public health debate, obviously, obesity is a crisis in our country and across much of the world. And I think, obviously, getting therapeutic options is wonderful. And I hope that researchers will spend a lot of time focused on why does Ozempic cause weight loss, making sure that we understand that, understanding what other options are. There's already currently underway studies to see, can you put this in a pill format, which would lower the cost and make it easier for people to take than having to give an injection every week. But I think the other thing is that we need to look at obesity as a much more complex issue than it is. First of all, we have seen growing childhood obesity, and oftentimes these are family problems and need to be managed as an entire family. And so that's a concern. Another concern is obviously people love the convenience of just give me a pill for this or that. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's great to have that option, but obesity, getting the weight down, is not the only thing that is affecting risk. It's other habits too. It may be related to poor diet that could still cause problems with cholesterol and other problems that could affect risk, but also if the lifestyle is too sedentary. And we don't want people to take a shot instead of getting out to exercise. I think the best combination is that if for people that really want to engage in changing their lifestyle, one of the things that's really hard about that, as anybody that's made New Year's resolutions knows, is that you get you get in the mood, you get all set to do this, but then you may not be getting the results that are reinforcing enough to keep you doing it. I think that where this could come in handy is helping people get that initial boost to help them encouraged and to engage in better lifestyle management. And it's important because the preliminary information we have is once you stop this medication, you regain the weight. So obviously that's mm-hmm. not going to be good.
Well, and you know, one of the things that stood out to me, Dr. Payne, in this article I mentioned from Forbes, is this doctor says, you know, the treatment of obesity must focus on enhancing the overall health and well-being of individuals and not necessarily decreasing the number on the weight machine. And it goes on to talk about studies, as you mentioned, about having a much higher risk of dying from cardiovascular disease if you have a sedentary lifestyle. And not all people who are overweight have a sedentary lifestyle. There are thin people who have a sedentary lifestyle. And yet, I think we have a culture that believes that the thinner you are, the healthier you are. In particular, when we now see these celebrities taking this medication who didn't need to lose weight, but are now, you know, so thin. And so, I mean, just anecdotally, this concerns me as a mom, right? And as what our kids are seeing about, you know, weight loss, if that makes sense.
Well, it totally does. And I think you raise a number of issues. One is, what is our messaging to children? Because what you want to do is set children up for a healthy life as adults. And therefore, we want to instill good lifestyle choices in children and not giving them the message that they need to take a shot or a pill. The second thing is exactly what you said. You know, the issues around particularly teenage girls, the pressures that they're under is really sick. And we have to make sure that we're not fostering or perpetuating those very bad body aspirations and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that's a real danger. And of course, for those that do have, you know, body dysmorphia or a disconnect between what their real body weight is and what and their own thoughts about whether they're still fat or whatever, you know, that can lead to abuse of medications like this and perpetuating eating disorders and other problems. So I think what you've exposed here, Gemma, through all of this is that we're talking about a much more complicated issue, mm-hmm. as you said, than just what the number on the scale is. Yes, we want to bring down obesity in this country, both in children and adults. And yes, I think there could be and is a role for pharmaceutical agents to do that. But I do think we make a mistake when we just focus on what is the easy way out instead of talking about that being some adjunct to an overall healthy lifestyle program.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears now, because I wanted to get to a topic that we were not able to get to last week. And this is the fact that the federal government, Dr. Pate, recently released the declassified report on the origins of COVID. Now, this has, people have a lot of thoughts on this, on how it actually happened. What do we know now?
Yeah, this was fascinating. I wrote about this topic long ago and explained that based on what was publicly available, I couldn't rule out a lab leak, so-called lab leak, nor could I prove that this was a zoonotic transmission, in other words, from wildlife to humans. However, all the evidence that was publicly available certainly weighed heavily on the side of this being a zoonotic transmission, most likely from the wet markets in China. And of course, we know, and there's, I don't know of any serious debate on this, that the outbreak in 2003 of the original SARS virus was from those wet markets, and we've even pinned down the animals. So there's been all this debate. And what I qualified my opinion about when I wrote about this months ago was, however, we know that there's information that the government has that's classified that we don't have access to. And depending on what that was, maybe that would change my assessment. However, all of those, the intelligence agencies were split, some saying, yeah, the evidence leans towards the zoonotic transmission, some saying, no, it leans towards a lab leak, and some saying, well, we can't tell at all. But all of those agencies, save one, said their assessments were low confidence, which really means in intelligence agency speak that they don't have really any credible evidence to support this that they could really rely on. The FBI was the only agency to come out with a moderate level. So I've been really anxious to hear what they have after President Biden and Congress signed into law that the federal agencies have to declassify as much of this as they can. So I looked through the report, and what the report does is actually only strengthen my view because they have pretty much eliminated all of the theories that had been going around. There were theories naming several scientists that they said had COVID prior to the outbreak that worked in that Wuhan Institute of Virology. This report dismisses that and said, yes, there were some researchers that got ill. However, that's also the time when they were having their influenza outbreak because they have it a little bit different than we do, and that the no one got hospitalized, and that the information they had about these researchers that got ill, quote, neither supports nor refutes either hypothesis of the pandemic's origins because the researchers' symptoms could have been caused by a number of diseases, and some of those symptoms were not consistent with COVID. So kind of shot that down. There's also been a lot out there that the lab had the virus ahead of time before the breakout. And this report shows us that all of their findings are, no, they didn't. They didn't have the virus until they were actually provided with samples from people from the outbreak to try to help identify what the virus was. So, you know, we're still not going to have the answer. I think the preponderance of the evidence is that this was spread from the market. However, at this point, I think more important than answering that question is how do we take all of this information and how do we make things safer and prevent the next pandemic?
Right. Absolutely. Well, as always, Dr. Pate, we so appreciate your time and your expertise. Of course, we will see you next week. So really appreciate you.
My pleasure. See you then.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.